This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Yes, it's time for me, Professor Buzzkill, that is. You know, we usually hear that surgery and medical treatment during the Civil War was backward butchery. But was it? Well, let's cross over the intersphere to listen as historian Nick Kaufman from Kennesaw State University tells us how complicated it really was. Here we go. Well, Buzzkillers, fortunately, because of the magic of the internet, we have on the line Professor Nick Kaufman, teaches at Kennesaw State University and works on the Civil War period, American Civil War period, and specializes in the history of medicine, the history of science. Professor, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you today?
Very, very well. You know, the Civil War is seen as such absolute butchery. It seems that every time we see it depicted in movies or on TV or anything like that, we see amputations, we see stacks of limbs. And I recently watched the Lincoln movie from a couple of years ago. I saw it again. And, you know, there are a lot of images of him going to the old soldiers' homes, and they seem to all the time be burying amputated limbs. It's all grisly and everything like that. So our ideas about medicine and caring for soldiers in the Civil War seem to be that it was pretty grim.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to, of course, this is the show, right? I want to kind of change that around, but it's also, it is grim. It is grisly. All war is grim and grisly, and that's kind of the nature of it. But we look back on it as this kind of horrible, barbarous age, and you know, my job is to kind of look at it and see, is this outside the norm? What kind of things come out of it? And frankly, from what I find is not only that it's optimistic in some ways,
yeah,
we develop kind of this modern medical system because of the barbary, the horrors, and it actually improves how healthcare works in a lot of ways.
Is it because, just the brief answer, is it because it intensifies the need for, you know, extreme medicine, extreme surgery, and so there's this four-year period where medicine suddenly has to really become accelerated?
Yes, and it's everywhere.
Ah,
you know,
I see.
Think of you as, if you're a Southerner, you're not only seeing Confederates return home wounded, but you're seeing Union soldiers wounded. You might go back to your fields for the first time in months, and it could be littered with bodies.
Ah.
And you're dealing with shortages. You're dealing with supply issues.
Right.
And so the old medical system literally just collapses around them.
Okay. Well, let's get to that. The old medical system, medical care before the Civil War. What's going on in the 1840s and 1850s leading up to, you know, Fort Sumter?
Well, for you buzzkillers out there, if you go to the University of Pennsylvania or to the Mutter Museum, there's this great kind of example of 1840s medicine.
Oh.
In the Spanish American War, okay, excuse me, not Spanish American, in the Mexican American War,
right,
there are so few amputations done, they keep them all. And they're all in jars. There's only a dozen of them or so, and they're in formaldehyde.
Oh.
And they were so proud that these people got the amputations and survived, we just kept them.
Kept them to use in medical teaching? Or just, it seems unnecessarily grisly.
Well, I mean, we're not saying that they're like prizes, like an antler mounted on the wall. But,
okay.
You know, in some ways, as a doctor, that's kind of what you had, right?
Okay.
You know, you went to medical school, kind of. It's not really what we think of medical school today. Generally, you went for a year.
Yeah.
And then you repeated the same classes the next year and hoped for the best. And then there was kind of an apprenticeship, you know?
Yeah.
And the doctor was generally the guy in town who had done it before. You called him doc. There wasn't like a certification process.
Oh.
And that's kind of how medicine went. You know, people think of homeopathy today as kind of this flippant thing. It's, you know, ancient Chinese quote-unquote medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, there really isn't medicine. And so anything that kind of worked, even if anecdotally, you bottled and you packaged and you hope for the best, we tend to associate patent medicines later. But it's pretty much the same. Cinnamon for diabetes and, you know, aspirin comes from the bark of trees, and that kind of stuff was all they really had.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but there is no standardization. There is no medical book. You know, Grey's Anatomy is relatively new.
Grey's Anatomy being that fantastic volume of drawings and everything that, that really showed or really helped teach anatomy and other important parts of medicine surgery in the 19th century.
Exactly right. And it's based a lot, for the most part, off of the Greeks and then modernized slightly by kind of the Victorian medical community.
Wow. So in other words, is medicine, you know, in this period running up to the Civil War sort of hit or miss? It's like, well, cinnamon has worked for this long period and we're not going to test it. We're just going to use it. We get aspirin from bark. We're not going to test that. We're just going to use it because it's worked before.
Exactly. I mean, if anything, you would not consider it scientific. Scientific process of running these tests. Sometimes, I mean, you could do countless examples of, you know, using mercury for syphilis and like these horrible treatments that never worked.
Right. Worse than a disease. Yeah.
Frankly, the best cures, the cures that work the best that kind of come along are your sanitarium, your health cures where you go out to the countryside. Mm-hmm. Cities were filthy. Sanitation was poor. And sometimes just getting away from the vector of your disease, the bad water, the bad air, might give you a spitting chance. You know, this is a time when even our diets weren't particularly good. Gastroenteritis, you know, kind of grumbly tummy pain, gas, that kind of stuff was called the American disease. We ate pork 3 times a day and we just, and, you know, it's not good for anyone.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing changes in American history in the broad sweep that people don't realize is how much pork was consumed certainly throughout the 19th century into the early 20th century at least.
And in a period before proper canning techniques, you know, and refrigeration, it's not like you had vegetables or fruit through the winter. Yeah. You generally had a chunk of meat that was either frozen outside or jerky or cured. And that's kind of what you survived off of along with fermentation, beer or whiskey diluted, because the water generally wasn't great either.
Yeah, it was not exactly the best environment then to start going into war.
Right. And, you know, as the war begins, kind of, you have to put that into perspective as well. It's not just that you have illness, because you have more illnesses in the war than you can possibly fathom. But you also just don't have supplies.
Right.
There's shortages immediately. There's food issues immediately. By the end of the war, it's even worse. But at first, people just are malnourished to start off.
Oh, so they're malnourished coming into the armies, both armies. Or a lot of them are.
A lot of them are, and a lot of them are coming from far distances. You know, and the train rides aren't great, and they're kind of share. If you're a Union soldier, of course, you know, getting from Ohio down to, let's say, Tennessee takes a few days. You're packed into these cattle cars, effectively. You're not eating well. And while the Union does get its logistics together pretty much by 61, 62, we start having shortages by 63. The Confederacy starts seeing shortages almost immediately.
Right. Is there a kind of a shock for not only the military but the public because it's happening on their land essentially? You know, it's the only war since the Revolution that is largely happening in where all the people live. Most of the other wars were in the Southwest or other places. That all this stuff is happening and they're seeing it?
It is. And, you know, you can argue whether or not the Civil War is a total war. Yeah. But there are definitely elements to it that are unquestionably. Like when you're talking something like Sherman's March to the Sea, it's not just that they're – like we in Georgia like to tell the story of they burned it all to the ground.
Yeah.
But what they were really doing too is finding a granary and trying to eat. Like, and they're like locusts descending because he had tens of thousands of people – that weren't really carrying supplies so they could go as quickly as possible. And if you see that great blue army marching across, eating everything in its path, that really does kind of change your perspective on what this looks like.
Yeah, of course, we don't hear that, of course, we don't think that needs to be done. The army needs to be fed. people tend to only think about the battles and the burning to the ground. But in fact, some of the burning, some of the elimination of the primary foodstuffs in Georgia is the same thing.
Yeah. And it's the Napoleonic line, which is an army marches on its stomach.
Right.
You know, and that's why they developed canning to make that kind of thing work. Only about 20 years before the 1840s that we were talking about, you know.
So. Oh, okay. So how does, after, I suppose there wasn't a great deal of carnage at Fort Sumter, but once the war starts to spread and there are these big battles, how does medicine and surgery and medical surgeon, army surgeon, how does that initially react?
Well, there's a lot of very crazy issues at first. The U.S. military, of course, has this issue where it divides almost immediately in half. And you kind of know the story. Like, a lot of the officers are in the Deep South. However, a lot of the wealth is in the North. So a lot of the people who trained to be doctors and then ended up being in the military for whatever reason, maybe they needed to pay off some debt, maybe they – you know, couldn't find practice.
Mm-hmm.
The medical schools were pumping out a lot of people that needed experience, but there weren't really traditional hospitals quite yet.
Oh, okay.
So a lot of them ended up working kind of as medical, you know, officers to hopefully get a little bit of experience. But a lot of them were Northerners because that's where the money was. That's where the medical school was. When the war first started, there were about 24 surgeons associated with the U.S. military.
Yeah.
Only 3 ended up in the Confederacy.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's quite a difference.
That's quite a problem.
Yeah.
And it becomes a problem, of course, because then they have to train these people. And as you can imagine, setting up emergency schools is not an ideal way to kind of prepare
No, because you're medical officers. You're building up the military first, and then you have to do something like that in the background. It's very difficult.
It is. You kind of have this problem wherein – the Confederacy has no documentation. They have no structure. So what they do is they originally they copy the military guide of the U.S. military, the Union Army, and they leave off a decimal point. So instead of having a required, 3 surgeons, 1 head surgeon and 2 assistant surgeons for every 500 men, they do it for every 5,000 men, and there's no funding at all. And so these men are not being paid. They're not being properly taken care of. And that's why you have this weird kind of dissension in the Confederate Army, wherein they want to defend their home state, but they have no real tie to the country as a whole. And that becomes a huge issue.
Oh, so they think of themselves as Georgians and maybe Georgian surgeons, but not necessarily Confederate surgeons. So going off to fight in Tennessee or Virginia is maybe not part of their emotional attachment.
And then taking care of soldiers from other states.
Yeah.
That becomes a problem. It really does.
Is there any, there must have been, I assume there must have been, but differences in artillery or differences in munitions, changes, I hate to call them improvements because they're so lethal and brutal, in the 1840s and 1850s that are used in the Civil War for perhaps the first time, does that make it worse? Do doctors have to say, we've never seen a wound of this type before because there never have been wounds of this type before because they didn't have whatever bullets, those kind of bullets or those kind of shells.
Yeah. And that really comes in the form of the mini ball.
Okay.
Yeah. The mini ball, which, if you had a cool high school teacher, they probably had one of these. They passed them around. I had one and I used one in my own lectures, but they're made out of a kind of soft lead.
Yeah.
They're shaped almost like a cartoon bullet with a little hollow dimple out of the back.
Yeah.
The problem with them is when they're fired out of these kind of long rifles, the lead gets heated and the lead gets soft. So when it strikes a limb or a bone, it doesn't penetrate. It doesn't puncture. It slams into the bone, which causes the bone to fracture, to shatter.
Oh, okay. Because it's not sharp enough, it doesn't go through you. It widens out and does more damage.
Exactly right. And it was completely unintentional. It's kind of modern lead techniques. They traveled better than a traditional musket ball, for example.
Yeah.
But for the soldier on the field, this is why those amputations became so necessary.
Okay.
And these are French bullets. And in the wars that kind of build up to this, Napoleon III, the revolutions of the 1840s, they discovered that shock is greatest in the first 3 hours. And if you're still in shock, because they don't really have anesthetic in the way we think of it, the amputation is safer within those first 3 hours. If it goes after that, the chance of death increases by 92%.
Oh, so the idea is that you're still in shock. You're still in shock, and you're not going to feel as much pain from the amputation sort of immediately after the wound. Whereas if you wait and see whether anything is going to get better, it might be worse.
Exactly right. Ugh. I mean, I didn't get into this, but I can briefly. Surgery in the 1840s and 50s is a nightmare. It's truly a nightmare. If you go to old medical schools or medical hospitals, the surgery theater, the amphitheater that you kind of look down in and see the professor giving his lecture is on the top floor of the building, so you can't hear the yelling from the street.
You'd
have these kind of four burly assistants hold the person down to conduct surgery, because the surgery was done with the person fully conscious and screaming. There was something like a 20% suicide rate rather than go into surgery.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's not exactly, it doesn't actually call for recommendation for the new medicine of the 1840s and 50s.
But just to flip it around for a second, can you imagine the opposite of the deathly silence of anesthesia?
Yeah.
Right? Because at least if they're talking, they're alive. They're okay. You know, this is this is kind of getting into the monster of Victorian England. Like, you know, things like Frankenstein and Dracula. You know, Dracula steals your blood. And if you've ever donated blood, you know, you feel like drained. You feel dead. You go pale. It was for that reason that transfusions of blood were actually banned in most European countries and the U.S. because I was stealing your essence to make myself stronger.
Yeah.
And so transfusions of things like milk and whiskey were actually done for many years.
Oh, okay.
And so when we're talking about this, the idea of anesthetic becomes truly terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. I'm giving you a chemical. You're not awake. You're not dead. You're not asleep. But you might wake up later if I did it right. That's you have to imagine in those first operating theaters where ether was used for the first time, they were wondering if they literally just watched a man kill someone else.
Right, because when you're under, it looks like you're dead, but you're not.
Exactly.
So is this what's being practiced and developed in the 1840s and 50s and then is used in the early stages of the war?
Yes. In Georgia, there's a guy named Crawford Long who develops ether,
right.
But it kind of explodes across the country. We also have nitrous oxide, of course, where you have nitrous and ether frolics where people kind of just use them as recreational drugs until someone realized, a dentist realizes that, hey, we can pull teeth with this, and it starts to spread and starts to spread. The problem, of course, is using unstable chemicals on the battlefield.
Right.
Generally, if they're near major cities, Chattanooga, outside the Battle of Bull Run, where you're near Washington, D.C., you can get these chemicals and you can use them. But in an era before, you know, modern sphygmomanometers and blood pressure cuffs and all this stuff that makes you know that, you know, the person is actually under.
Yeah.
It's sometimes hard to know exactly how much to use. And subsequently, the most common anesthetic was actually just straight whiskey.
Right. Which would take a little while to work.
It would, and then they'd put a bullet in your teeth and hope that you didn't bite through your tongue.
Ugh,
you know.
Yeah. And so how does the Confederacy more or less react to only having three surgeons per 5,000 men when it's obvious that this is going to be it's obvious in 61, 62, this is going to be a very mechanical war with lots of injuries that aren't fatal that you might be able to save if you use the right medicine, but they don't have enough. They don't have enough doctors.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you kind of alluded to, they panic and they start recruiting in huge numbers. They start training as quickly as they can, but a lot of these people aren't properly paid for a long time. I'm sure people out there in Radio Land know the Confederate currency essentially bottoms out. They start printing like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big part of it, that they have no money to pay their soldiers, they have no money to pay their specialists, and they're short on everything.
Oh, okay. And what's happening on the union side during this time? Are they being, you know, the standard story is that the union is already by 62 starting to overwhelm the Confederacy industrially. Mm-hmm. Are they also overwhelming, or have they already got such a lead in medicine that they're, you know, they're going to win anyway?
They definitely have a lead, but that lead becomes heavily bureaucratic and actually kind of problematic.
Oh.
Yeah. This is kind of one of those first agents of change, and actually one of the people that a lot of my students know about, Dorothea Dix, kind of steps to the plate.
Yeah, yeah.
Dorothea Dix, you might know her from her asylum reform or fixing the penal system and saying, you know, people who are mentally ill are not criminals. But during the Civil War, she becomes the first woman who's in charge of a major branch of the military. In fact, she is in charge of the entire nursing corps for the U.S. Union Army.
Huh.
And she's appointed because of her popularity during this movement, you know, during her asylum reforms and during her penal reforms, right?
Yeah.
There was another woman up for it, a woman named Elizabeth Blackwell, who was the first female MD in the United States.
Oh.
And her sister, in fact, was the third. But unfortunately, those two were very anti-slavery. And at the beginning of the war, they were still there was people in Congress who were still thinking that they could end this war quickly if they allowed slavery to stay intact. So they chose Dorothea Dix, who saw slavery as not a problem. She was okay with it. She said they looked happy.
Oh God. So in other words, Elizabeth Blackwell says, I'm not gonna work for a union army or a union cause that still will give up on eradicating slavery so easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so the union goes to Dorothea Dix because she doesn't have those scruples, is what you're saying.
Exactly right. And you know, and so Elizabeth Blackwell becomes kind of a political hot potato.
Oh.
And so she does what a lot of political hot potatoes do. She starts her own nursing program,
mm-hmm.
which we can get a little bit more into later. But, you know, your question was, how does the union cope?
Right.
They have
right.
a lot of doctors. But what turns out to be the thing that they need the most of are nurses, the people who take care of the patients after they've had their amputations, the ones who treat people while the war is still going on, while the battle is still going on. And there is no structure in place for that. You know, the union can hand out medical tests.
Yeah.
And they have a very quick standardization. And I've looked at some of these medical tests, and some of them are weird, like describing how healthy pus tastes versus non-healthy pus. Don't worry. Yeah, gross.
Yeah.
But nursing is a little bit more subjective, because there's not really a standard for what it does, because the doctor was supposed to do almost everything. The nurses did the care afterwards. And so, you know, this is kind of like Florence Nightingale. You know, this is what we need to be thinking about, because that the Crimea is effectively to Europe what the Civil War is to the United States here. The change in how we treat our soldiers, the change in how this overwhelming death makes us recalibrate everything.
Yeah, I would remind the Buzzkills, Florence Nightingale operated in the Crimean War as a nurse in the British Army in the early 1850s, and was often given perhaps exaggerated plaudits for what she did, but was certainly is in the popular memory known as the, you know, the lady with the lamp and the great savior of a great many soldiers.
Exactly. So when we're talking about the nursing corps and we're talking about the union structure, remember, it is a huge bureaucracy. Everyone is kind of piled up on top of each other to a pyramid leading up to the president, eventually to, of course, Ulysses S. Grant as the head of the military. The nursing corps works the same way. Dorothea Dix is in charge of this huge network of nurses. You have the U.S. Surgeon General, who's in charge of all of the doctors. Generally, they're linked to a general. Problem is, Dorothea Dix really doesn't like these women being in non-Christian environments. She was a moralist. And the reason why, even in the asylum world, that she thought these prisoners or these mentally ill people were not prisoners was this kind of Christian compassion idea, which works mm-hmm. fine there. Unfortunately, when you're talking about nurses, she didn't want anyone too young. She didn't want anyone too attractive. And so she was cutting all these volunteers who wanted to be nurses, but she found, quote unquote, distracting to the men.
Oh, so, and she doesn't want the nurses around, you know, soldiers who might be grabby and all kinds of other things, is what, as she thinks.
Exactly right. Meanwhile, Elizabeth Blackwell had no such concern. She knew that they needed nurses.
Yeah.
And so she was willing to train them anyway. And Blackwell trained so many nurses, along with help from the Sanitary Commission and the Western Sanitary Commission, that Dorothea Dix essentially is stripped of all of her power, and the generals get to hire the nurses that they want instead.
Oh,
this
okay.
allows for a huge structure of nurses to kind of move into the field and, you know, again, save countless lives. We have to remember that everything, no matter how grim, and I mean, your outline says that we have this idea that the Civil War is butchery.
Yeah.
And again, like all war, it's horrible. But these are these moments where a simple decision does save thousands of lives. If the amputation doesn't take place, that man is dead. From gangrene, from a bones infection, he's dead. If he doesn't get the care afterwards, he dies of shock afterwards anyway.
Yeah, so it's not like the doctors are amputation happy. This really is a necessity.
Mm-hmm. We have to, again, remember, this is not like you fell off your bike and broke the bone and it's a clean fracture.
Yeah.
This is someone taking a hammer to your leg and shattering.
Yeah.
And I know that's crude, but this is what's happening when these mini balls are hitting these people. And if you don't amputate it, these people die. And sometimes even if they do amputate, they die.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, on this happy note, we need to take a sponsorship break. And we won't be advertising mini balls because they won't sponsor us, but they can contact us if they want to. And we'll be back in a minute. Okay, we're back with Professor Nick Hoffman, who's telling us all about Civil War medicine and the zillions of complications involved. What you talked about before the break was so fascinating was that, in effect, the South is hindered by being behind and not having enough medical personnel, and the North is hindered by they have plenty of medical personnel, but they decided to launch this whole bureaucracy, which takes a while to get going. Anything better by the time 1862 rolls around, 63?
Sure. You know, and we need to remember that for the most part, everyone's trying to save lives. This isn't some villainous plot, right?
Yeah.
And you do have these weird wild cards. And they're, again, they're people you know probably, like Clara Barton is a good example, which mm-hmm. we'll get to later. But I think a perfect example of this is triage.
Okay.
If you've ever been every time there's a natural disaster, every time there is a major accident, right, that you can picture the nurse at the table, and he or she is saying, you need this, and they're sending people to rooms, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's developed at this time, okay?
Okay.
At the first Battle of Bull Run, everyone knows the battle. It's very, I almost want to say silly, but you can't ever say silly.
No, right? Not a Civil War, yeah.
But
what's the year again? The first Battle of Bull Run is 62?
Bull Run is July 21st, 1861.
Okay? 61, all right, okay, okay.
This is literally the first major battle of the war.
Right, okay.
So you have General P.G.T. Beauregard from the Confederacy, and he's making an attack on Washington, D.C., he's mm-hmm. stopped just outside of Washington, D.C. by Winfield Scott, who's the head of the military at the time, Irving McDowell, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a disaster. There's about 35,000 people on each side. The U.S. military is literally defending the Capitol against a Confederate threat, and they break ranks and run away.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Partly because of the shock of, you know, of the type of warfare that's going on.
Exactly right. Now, that being said, it was considered such a joke that people were having their picnic lunches up on the hillside to watch this happen.
Yes, that's a terrible image, but it's true. You know, it's absolutely true.
It is. And that matters because the Confederates hadn't been given rations that day. So when the Confederates start to march and they give the rebel yell and the Union runs away, the picnickers flee, and then the Confederates go and eat their lunches.
Oh, I hate to laugh, but talk about the phrase, I'm going to eat your lunch.
Literally. This is literally what it is. That, of course, gives Scott and McDowell time to reinforce D.C., and P.G.T. Beauregard never even makes it.
Right, okay. Right, okay.
The reason I bring that story up, other than it's hilarious, is that at the time, it took 2 weeks to get all the Union wounded off the grounds.
2 weeks?
2 weeks.
Wow.
Some were treated there, but they were essentially left in kind of these wooden brackets, almost, you know, like kind of, you see like a rickshaw.
Yeah.
And they were left, there was temporary hospitals, it wasn't any good. There's a guy named John Letterman. John Letterman is a colonel in the military, in the mm-hmm. Union military. He eventually becomes a major, but he comes up with this idea of ambulances as a form of triage. The ambulances would pull up in certain areas to assess people. The ones that were savable would be taken to the hospital. The ones that could walk would be told where to go. And the ones that were really wounded would be given care, but not waste good medicine on two wounded people to survive effectively.
Oh, that would, they thought would die anyway before they even got to the hospital.
Exactly right. So by the time the 4th of July, 1863 happens at Gettysburg, the bloodiest battle in American history, four times as many soldiers, thousands wounded, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone is off the bloody grounds the day after the battle ends.
Oh, so that's an enormous change. 2 weeks and to almost exactly, immediately.
Exactly right. And for anyone out there who's taken first aid, you know, the most important thing is to get that care immediately.
Yeah.
Not even just from me saying, you know, amputations are best in the first 3 hours, which whatever. It's simple things like if you are wounded from shrapnel, putting mm-hmm. clean gauze on it and getting you off the ground where it's dirty and smoky and dusty and bloody.
Yeah.
That will save your life.
Yeah. Even in theory, a relatively minor wound.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So that's, and that's only from 1861 to 63. So that's a pretty quick improvement.
And to your point earlier, and kind of what we were talking about, because of the staunch, rigid bureaucracy of the Union, Letterman is allowed to try this with his army. However,
who's Letterman again?
Excuse me, John Letterman is the one who develops the system of triage.
Oh, sorry, yeah, right. We're using the ambulance. Okay, gotcha.
As he does this, once it clearly works, it spreads across the entire military by the end of 1863.
Oh, okay. Do the Confederates notice this and start to use it on their side?
They do, but again, each army is run separately.
Oh.
So some people adopt it almost immediately, and you find copies of Letterman's text starting to appear in Confederate hands, but it just doesn't click as quickly as it could, right? It doesn't spread, and so some doctors do end up using it, some just don't, and those people suffer because of it.
Now this makes me realize that the articles I read where they talk about later in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, 1860s, 70s, obviously, you know, it wasn't uncommon at all to see Civil War amputees in your town. You know, that it was that the you know, lots of men did survive, and getting them off the battlefield as quickly as that obviously made a huge difference. So in other words, the American public would the memory of the Civil War or the impact of the Civil War would be seen more obviously to people of later generations, first couple of later generations, because of this ambulance technique, this triage technique.
Absolutely. And it's really kind of interesting to put it in that terms, because you can imagine immediately after the war, some 400,000 amputations are given. So we become a nation of the handicapped. We become this nation where, you know, like you said, not only is it not uncommon, but then you have this structure around them where how do you take care of these people? How do you treat these people? You know, this is a time before penicillin, so infections are possible.
Yeah. Okay, so we're still talking 1863, the end of 1863. How have other aspects of medical treatment changed and surgery changed at that kind of midpoint in the war?
Sure. Well, you know, the ambulance and the triage system are kind of giving way to what it actually means to take care of people by medicine. If you look at what John Letterman actually puts in an ambulance, it's things like coffee and beef stock and crackers and nutmeg and tea. And it's not because he was ignorant on things, but it's because if you had a good meal, your chances of surviving your wounds improved dramatically.
Oh, because it gave you energy and your body had chance to try to repair those cells and on and on and on.
And again, let's not forget, most of these people were incredibly malnourished. By the time we get to 1864 and 1865, Confederates were actually picking corn out of the manure of the horses. Like, there's horrible side effects here. And in fact, I guess a little bit of a small interesting tangent, there's a condition called nyctalopia. I'm sure your listeners know scurvy. Scurvy is something that we kind of pick up from pirates, where if you don't get citrus, you get a condition wherein your teeth fall out, your hair falls out, and eventually your nose falls off, and then you die. So the Americans kept oranges around. The British kept limes around on their ship, which is why they are called limeys, the British Navy.
That's right,
If you don't get vitamin A, something else happens to you, often corresponding with scurvy. But if you obviously, when your mom told you to eat your carrots, it was to get vitamin A and beta carotene. While it doesn't give you x-ray vision, it does help you see in the dark. Mm-hmm. With shortages, the actual rods in your eye, the things that tell light from dark, start to wither and die. And so we have Civil War battles. And this was only discovered in the late 80s. But the Union Army, because of the dusk, because of the stars and the moon, could fight much later into the night than the Confederates, because the Confederates were so malnourished without fresh vegetables, they didn't know where the bullets or the cannonballs were even coming from.
It's almost as if the difference in medical treatment and the difference in nutrition is its own weapon, its own division, its own, you know, army on its own that is helping to make the Northern dominance so dominant.
I mean, if you want to talk about turning points, there's a kind of historical debate going on the Battle of Vicksburg. Starting at the very beginning of the war, Winfield Scott says what you need to do is strangle the South like an anaconda. You cover the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic seaboard, you go down the Mississippi, and then you squeeze.
Yeah.
Well, by spring of 1863, the last place on the Mississippi River was Vicksburg.
Yeah.
It's this fortress up on a hillside, and Ulysses S. Grant is fighting it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Unfortunately, the Mississippi River floods a lot. It's murky, it's swampy, and his men are in the mud, and malaria breaks out. Now, for those of you who don't know, malaria is a protozoan disease spread by mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And back then especially, if you got it, you never are cured.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, we can treat it, but it stays in your blood forever.
Yeah.
It's a horrible disease. You get fevers of over 104. Incredible shakes, and it could go away for months, it could go away for years, but it comes back with a vengeance every single time. It's one of the oldest medicines we actually have. It comes from a South American / African tree called quinine. And if you've ever bought tonic water, it is the bitter flavorant in tonic water.
Hmm.
Yeah. That and whiskey, or that and gin, were mixed together because juniper was thought to have medicinal qualities by the British, and hence the gin and tonic was born.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We get into Belgians and acne medicine later, but that's a whole other thing.
So a lot of these things are medicinal, but what about also surgery? How has that changed by late 63, 64?
Surgery is improved by efficiency and by, I guess, kind of medicine when you could get it, right? You do still have the field where there's not good medical treatments, okay?
Right.
That's just how it is. But by the time we get to 63, 64, some doctors are touting that they have a 75-second average for an arm amputation. 74 seconds.
That's really working the saw very quickly.
And sealing.
Yeah.
And cauterizing. Oh. And everything. Yeah. Like, that is, I mean, you know, I know we don't want to get too, you know, intellectual historian here, but you have to understand, in the 1840s, an individual was an individual. You had a doctor who knew you specifically. That doesn't work when you have 4 million sick people at once.
Right, okay? right.
Over the course of 5 years, the Union Army has 21 million cases of dysentery so bad people can't fight.
Ugh.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so this is the viewing of people like machines for the first time. Right.
Okay. That bodies essentially work the same, and that there isn't enough personal difference to make a difference, at least in terms of military medicine.
Exactly right. You know, if you're thinking like as a Catholic, you can't burn the body because the body has to be whole.
Yeah.
You know, like, but nowadays, if I got my appendix removed, I don't expect to take it home because it's a part of me.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so that's a big change in surgery. These are assembly lines that are dealing with broken machines, like in a mechanic changing the oil. That distance matters because it allows people to have to make hard decisions, to be quicker, to be more efficient. And yes, we are now in the modern medicine, in the 21st century, realizing that there are inherent flaws in that logic as well.
Yeah.
But this important step mattered a lot, because then you see a soldier that has this wound, you have to amputate. You can't let him talk you out of it. You can't make him promise that, well, I'll work out and it will be fine. No. Yeah. It has to go. Otherwise, you're going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, one of the reasons why after the war, it's very common to see soldiers with amputations, veterans with amputations. We've talked a lot in the early part of the show, before the break, about Dorothea Dix and Elizabeth Blackwell and other major people involved in the organization. Are these type of people still making these changes as the war's going on? In other words, it seems to me that medical improvements and medical reforms are happening almost daily throughout the 1860s. And does that mean a lot more people, a lot more doctors at the high level or nurses at the high level are getting involved? And, you know, is it getting all the way up to Abraham Lincoln and he has to say, no, we're going to do this? You know, who are the type of people primarily responsible for at least making sure that medical reforms continue?
Well, again, as you were alluding to, it depends on the side, right?
In the South, I keep forgetting that, and it really is dramatic, the difference.
It is. And so let's talk about the Confederacy for a bit, because we really haven't as much. There is one person that we really should, you know, throw his name out. His name is Samuel Hollingworth Stout.
Yep, okay? That's a very good Confederate name.
It is. I didn't throw the Southern accent in this time, but I can't. General Stout. You know, but he has kind of this quintessential Southern story where he traces himself back to the old country, you know, to England, where his father was blah, 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 blah. And he tracks himself back 12 generations. You know, he's one of these people. But he had a standard medical education. He even learned in the North and then came back to the South. Mm-hmm. But when the war breaks out, he sides with the Confederacy. Him and his wife were living in Nashville at the time. And he, you know, starts to develop this attachment to, on one hand, the old ways. You know, he went to University of Pennsylvania. He followed this kind of structure of Benjamin Rush and you know, the traditional hospital system. But then as the Confederacy, as we mentioned before, is so fractured, it doesn't really link up in that way.
Yeah.
His power allows him to coordinate it. He starts out as the medical surgeon in charge of the Army of Tennessee, but is so successful there, he is put in charge of all hospitals in Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama.
Okay.
That allows him to institute these things that we were talking about. He is that bureaucratic link at the top that says, this is how hospitals should function. This is how triage should work. And while we don't have this rigid hierarchy from the top bottom as we do in the Union, he becomes that for a good region in the Deep South.
And do we see a major change in how well the South is now starting to cope with all these wounds and soldiers actually recovering and not dying on the battlefield before they can be treated?
Absolutely. And further, as Confederate states start to fall, his hospital system is left in place because it is so successful.
Oh, so do you mean Union armies start to say, well, you keep going and you treat the wounded who have already been defeated.
Right.
But okay, that's very fascinating. Okay.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that we haven't really gotten into. You know, the color one bleeds, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of a difficult problem to get around, because you're talking about a war where there's incredible shortages. Does that mean you're going to use some of your good gauze? Or, I mean, these are bandages. This isn't gauze, right? This is bandages that they reuse. So if someone dies, they then send them to a launderer to wash them and then use them again immediately.
Yeah.
Ew. But that's the honest truth. Are you going to use that clean bandage on a Confederate if you were a Union soldier?
Yeah, I don't know when the first idea of, you know, treating soldiers of all types, depending on the nature of their injury rather than the nature of their side, starts. But it's certainly the problem in the Korean and the World War II and the Korean War.
Exactly right. This starts around here, right where we're talking 63, 64. Huh. Clara Barton, for example, has to gain her own power before she can just do that, right? Because she's good at fundraising effectively at first. You know, she goes to her wealthy friends in New York and in Boston and Philadelphia asking for money, asking for supplies so she can go and treat soldiers. But at first, she treats primarily Union soldiers showing up at Fredericksburg and such.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's even stories of her working on soldiers as bullets are coming all around her, penetrating her blouse, killing the man she's working on and working on the next person. You know, she's a real, you know, one of those heroes that you just don't seem to exist anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yeah.
It's not until 1864 where she says, these are my supplies. I will treat everyone equally. And she starts dealing with the wounded Union next to Confederate, next to Union, next to Confederate, because allows her. I mean, the Red Cross is much more complicated than you think. Probably it existed in Europe around this time, but there's actually a treaty that the U.S. government had to accept. And so while she was calling herself, you know, kind of the American Red Cross, we're not technically part of the Red Cross until the 1880s.
Yeah.
But that's when it starts to happen.
So is she then able to, through the force of her personality and the force of her success in treatment on the battlefield, able to get around, you say, a Union general who says, no, you put Confederate soldiers last?
She is, and she effectively does so by setting up a hospital tent in the middle of the battlefield and just taking anyone who comes.
Wow.
Which, again, is somehow even crazier than every time I think about it.
Oh, you mean in the middle, in between the lines, like you're halfway, like the 50-yard line?
Effectively, if you're talking about where the marching band is warming up, she is watching. She is watching the volley happen and literally sending runners out to the field sometimes to pull people off the bloodied ground.
Wow.
It is crazy. And yeah, at night, battles kind of stop because you can't see. But oftentimes there was still a volley of cannon fire, you know, just to say, you're staying there. We know where you are. And so, you know, nurses do die, it's brutal.
Well, again, another happy note on which to take our second break, that we need to take our station ID break for the Buzzkill Nation. And we'll be back in a minute.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back with Professor Nick Hoffman, who's telling us all about how Civil War medicine changed in itself and also changed medicine. Professor, we left just before the war was ending, and so how does medicine and surgery change and improve in theory in late 64 and in the beginning of 65 when the war is winding down?
Sure. You know, the last few years of the war, it's the South in rapid retreat from different angles, mm-hmm. you know, and from all sides. The Union trying to rapidly advance. But we're talking about shortages on all sides. You know, effectively, there's a famine going on in the Deep South.
Wow.
People are starving on every step of the way, and you shouldn't watch this movie. It's awful. But they do talk about this in the Free State of Jones, the Matthew McConaughey movie, about, you know, the Confederate Army literally going to search for food at people's houses because there's no supplies left.
Oh, right. Yeah, that came out a year or two ago. Yeah, that movie.
I think two. And it's not a very good movie.
Well,
frankly, boring. But, you know, that is something they do. And you mentioned Lincoln. They kind of show this in Lincoln as well.
Right.
You know, so the end part of the war is effectively two things. It's setting up a new Union. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, we're remaking America and trying to figure it out. So those temporary hospitals are becoming ingrained hospitals. You know, the military bases throughout the South that the Union creates are creating an infrastructure. You know, that first federalized healthcare system is coming out of that.
Okay. You know, I didn't realize that. Okay.
And to your point, we're now dealing with hundreds of thousands of veterans that are, some are psychologically shattered.
Right.
If you look at the big magical medical book, there is a collection of every single death and illness and casualty on the Union side. It's 15 volumes, 1,000 pages long of every battle of every soldier. And someone went through and compiled everything. But there's over 1,000 cases of what you call nostalgia, where people literally have mental break and run home across battlefields.
Oh, they consider being nostalgic for home is a condition, and that's why you run away?
Exactly right. I mean, wow. Now we would call it PTSD, yeah. But that's what we're dealing with now in 1864. We're dealing with soldiers who grew up in Illinois, were taken to Tennessee, have seen monstrous death.
Yeah.
And now are expected to go home.
Yeah.
We are now dealing with a Confederate people who are effectively treated as a conquered nation.
Yeah.
That are seeing soldiers everywhere and they're now attacking those soldiers, but also starving to death. Yeah. And so the medical establishment is designed now to set up regularity.
Oh, okay. Okay. And does that eventually work? I mean, one of the things we wanted to get onto was, I mean, this is so fascinating about this whole story is how changes in the Civil War, in Civil War medicine and surgery, which were all happening at a very intensified time, intensified place, you know, how does that change medical care and philosophies of medical care, if you will, you know, for the rest of the century, the rest of the 19th century?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's what I'm trying to put my finger on. And it's difficult, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because on one hand, we essentially, as a union, as Americans in the North, set up a fully federalized healthcare system in the South. The okay. Reconstruction government sets up hospitals. They set up doctors. They treat anyone, including the freedmen.
Mm-hmm. Which
is brand new, right? You know, They were almost thought of as a different species. In fact, African-American graves were robbed so much, even of free blacks up north, that you would hire someone to wait by the grave for 10 days to make sure your body was too decomposed to be used in medical schools for autopsy.
Oh. Ugh.
I know. It's horrible. It is.
In other words, what you're saying is that's how big and in a way industrialized, organized, and massive medicine is becoming in the South because of the post-war need.
Exactly right. So the other kind of side of this is what is to be done with the South as a whole. And I mean, this is not a Reconstruction work or not discussion. You know, that's for Eric Foner and that's for another day. But, you know, that is kind of the problem. The South starts to see these people as not only interlopers, you know, the carpetbagger, all that kind of thing, but that these hospitals represent Union interference, American government interfering in the South. And so they start to become targets as well, not just the freedmen, but everything that is represented by the Reconstruction government, which is why by the time Grant is president, he institutes the Klan Acts to reinforce the military there.
Okay. Okay. So people are seeing in the South are seeing, some people in the South are seeing these new hospitals as Yankee interference and the carpetbagger hospitals, if you will. And is there any sort of idea that it's beyond that? It's that Yankees bringing in this industrial medicine, whereas we have old time medicine that's better, old family folk medicine. These people are ruining us, trying to turn us into robots.
You know, immediately there is this kind of need. And for a while there, it seems to be kind of working.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But by the time you get to the 1880s, the narrative starts to change. Not to get to whatever again, but there's this idea of the lost cause, that the Confederates had this noble purpose about states' rights, and these men acted nobly like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson.
Yeah.
Then it's okay to adopt some of these union practices as long as they're making it a Southern version. And that's when the segregation comes in. And that's when the changing the name starts coming in. And that's why the hospitals in Atlanta, where I live, are named after people like, you know, Confederate leaders and stuff, because
it confederatizes, I guess.
Crawford Long Hospital is named Crawford Long because he was the great Southern inventor of ether, even though he doesn't even own the patent on it.
Yeah. But rather than, you know, they changed the name from Union Hospital number 45 to Crawford Long. Yeah, right. Buzzkiller should know that Professor Hoffman is working at the cutting edge of history, like a lot of people who are working on their dissertations for finishing their PhDs. This is where a lot of the very new stuff is coming up. Can you tell us a little bit about the specific work that you're doing on this broad topic?
Sure. So let's just do this. One of my favorite stories, my favorite little vignettes to tell to explain why I do what I do has to do with great Southern general Stonewall Jackson.
Right.
Thomas Jackson is Lee's right-hand man. He's considered one of the best generals in American history. He worked primarily in the Eastern Front. So before the Battle of Fredericksburg, he is doing some reconnaissance work. He's wearing a dark jacket to kind of scope out the Union lines very secretively.
You mean so he could kind of look like a Union soldier from a distance? No one's going to shoot him. Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah, no one would shoot him except for his own men. He gets shot immediately by some of his own soldiers and falls off his horse. Yeah. His men's gunfire tells the Union, oh, crap, something's happening. So they also open gunfire. They rush out with a gurney to try to save this man's life, the great general's life. But bombs keep going off, so he falls off the gurney twice.
Yeah.
True. Okay. They take him to a medical hospital, okay, where they have to amputate his arm. His left arm is lost, okay?
Okay.
He fights the Battle of Fredericksburg, but
With one arm. He fights
with one arm.
Yeah.
However, just 8 days later, right as Chancellorsville is starting, he dies of pneumonia as a result of the infection he gets from his amputation.
Okay.
The reason I bring this up is if you go to Fredericksburg and you go to Chancellorsville, there are two separate monuments to him. Mm-hmm. One for his body and one for his arm.
His arm?
His arm has its own monument discovered by Smedley Butler. Now, I won't tell you guys who he is, but you can look him up. He's a fascinating guy in his own right.
Is the arm buried under the monument? Is it buried separately?
Yeah, it's actually there. It's buried separately. And that is what got me interested in this, okay?
Okay.
Because he is this perfect example of a great man who died on the battlefield.
Yeah.
If I lost my arm, that would be thrown out with the medical garbage.
Yeah.
For him, though, what makes the great man? Is it bits of him? Is it the whole him? Where does his soul lie? What part of him is Stonewall Jackson?
Oh, okay. Where does the heroism lie? The strength lies partly in the arm, things like that?
Exactly. Is it 20% of him dead on the battlefield, right?
Yeah. If he'd been an infantryman, his arm or anything else would have been thrown out with the waste, as you say.
Exactly right. And so they discover a little wooden coffin holding his arm outside of Fredericksville. So that's what interests me. How do we go from 12 arms, every single amputation done in the Mexican-American War being preserved, to being nowadays where American archaeologists still just occasionally find pits filled with limbs where they're essentially garbage?
Oh, okay. And that you just mentioned, it brought us back to the original idea that you mentioned early on, was that all these things in the Mexican-American War were preserved and brought north to a hospital and that you can still see them. And now we have arms being treated as medical waste, except for Stonewall Jackson.
And he happens right in the middle. He dies right in 63, right at this pivoting point.
Oh, I see. Now, does it make any difference that he's a Confederate general versus a Union general? In other words, I don't know how to phrase this, but were the Union medical officers less what's the word I'm looking for? Did they have less of an idea of heroism? I don't know if any Union generals lost their arms, but do we have an example of this sort of weird double burying happening on the Union side? They were less sentimental.
I think Well, first of all, no. This is a unique story as far as I can go, as far as I can tell. I'm still looking. Who knows? Yeah, maybe there's an under lieutenant somewhere.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
The thing that I think also it tells, and there's a great book called This Republic of Suffering that talks about what they do with the dead, which is a whole other story.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's also a sense of personal loss. I think it feeds in very well into what the Lost Cause becomes. That, you know, this is a great man who died protecting Robert E. Lee, the one of the greatest generals that this nation has ever known.
Yeah.
And he's willing to die. He is a martyr for the Confederacy. And so with that comes this great sense of loss.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that is also looking back. You know, we don't know what they were thinking exactly at that moment, because they might have just been like, the general would be very upset if we just threw this one with the lower rank and file.
Yeah.
And then the myth became around it, you know.
Okay. Okay.
And that's that kind of problem with memory as well. So
exactly. Well, we talk about that all the time on the show, memory and myth and how it's constructed and reconstructed. So Professor, thank you so much for this. It's been most illuminating, and I hope that the Buzzkillers have certainly learned a lot. What do you plan to work on next after this project is finished?
You know, I have this to, of course, publish, and that's a several-year-long cycle.
Yeah.
But, you know,
there must be a thousand topics sort of within this that can then provide work for decades.
Yeah, and I mentally, I'm also working on the kind of post-era where we get into kind of the sanitarium and modern America with hygiene, you know, the Kellogg's brothers and the invention of breakfast cereals and that kind of cure with the Grahamites. I find the linkage between health and cult thinking very fascinating.
Well, and that's why I constantly say on the show the 19th century is the most fascinating century to study.
Absolutely.
So thanks again, and Buzzkillers, we'll talk to you next week.